this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking from Washington, D.C. Now, this week again, the attention of the world is fixed on Reykjavik, Iceland, and on the battle of this gallant small country, this David facing the Goliath of the Anglo-Dutch Combine, joined by the International Monetary Fund and indeed by the Eurocrats and Eurogarchs of the Brussels European Commission. The issue is the attempt of London and The Hague, backed up by Dominique Strauss-Kahn and Barroso, to impose a $6 billion foreign debt on a country whose gross domestic product is only about $12 billion. Last week, we led with the electrifying news that Birgitta Jones-Dottir, the courageous and admirable leader of the movement, a faction in the Icelandic parliament, had in a debate a week and a half ago, called for a debt moratorium for Iceland. Iceland needs a debt moratorium, a debt stop, a debt freeze, a halt in all payments on principal and interest on foreign debt by Iceland vis-a-vis the Netherlands, vis-a-vis the British, and, well, take it from there. In addition, they've got, as Birgitta Jones-Dottir said in her speech, to get the IMF out, that the IMF and the European Commission had been hostile to Iceland. Now, we're getting some more details. Unfortunately, not yet the complete speech, but that's still in the works, and we hope to get it for you next time. Another deputy of that same group, Thor Saari, S-A-A-R-I, another member of the Icelandic parliament, also a member of the movement faction, one of three in that parliamentary group, also called for a debt moratorium in the same debate. And the word from Reykjavik is that at this point, a working group has been assembled with members of parliament from at least three parties, including the movement, and including also the Independence Party, the right-wing party, which had been devoted to liberal economics, neoliberal monetarist nostrums. It will now be seen whether they're serious or not. But the word is that there's now at least the nucleus, the seed crystal of a cross-faction caucus, the Anti-International Monetary Fund caucus in the Icelandic parliament, which can lead the country into a decent future. So we'll have more of that next time as we get the full text of the speech. Now, we also devoted significant time last week to this Robert Fisk article about an international group that was apparently coordinating to relist all of the world's oil out of the dollar. Now, it's a complicated situation, as we pointed out, but maybe one way to clarify it is to look at the very interesting commentary by Ria Novosti and a very perspicacious commentator, Vlad Grinkevich, G-R-I-N-K-E-V-I-C-H, at Ria Novosti, says a rumor reported by Robert Fisk in the London Independent created some panic in international financial markets. The Arab Gulf states allegedly talking to Russia, China, Japan, France to replace the U.S. dollar with a basket of currencies, including the Japanese yen, the Chinese yen, the euro, gold, and a new unified currency of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And this is an article where you got to read not so much the printed part, but between the lines. The printed part is the story is not unique. We've often had news stories affecting markets, and he goes through various examples. But let's get to the one that is, I think, the most relevant. Vlad Grinkevich writes, in 1992, famous financier George Soros initiated a bearish play to lower the British pound and won. The Bank of England withdrew their currency from the European exchange rate mechanism, devalued pound sterling by 33%, and Soros earned an estimated $1.1 billion in the process. You'll remember that. It was as if Soros had stolen, I think, 20 pounds from every man, woman, and child in the British Isles. This move, writes Grinkovich, made market analysts believe that Soros could manipulate the exchange rate single-handed, which was what he wanted. He said he would spare the Hungarian forint, but attack all others. Some analysts later blamed Soros for the Asian financial crisis of 1997. However, Grinkovich is also aware it's not just pure subjectivity. There is an objective side. One thing, he writes, that can be said about a financial market panic provoked by an unwitting or deliberate statement made by top officials and financiers, that the mistakes must be in tune with current trends to be believed. So what are we getting here? That the Fisk article may well have been assisted, a plant by Soros, seems to be the implication here. My, how interesting. We had all kinds of commentators around the world who immediately fell in line behind Robert Fisk, of course, who's a veteran British intelligence man, resident there in Beirut. He's part of the residual British intelligence presence left there. We saw Bill Engdahl, for example, on the Global Research of Canada, tagging right along in the wake of Fisk. More prudent, I think, to step back, as I tried to do, and said, look, there is obviously the need to replace the dollar as the world reserve currency. The dollar cannot do this alone anymore, but no other national currency can do this alone, and the worst of all possible worlds is to go to a supranational synthetic currency such as special drawing rights, the SDRs of the International Monetary Fund. And let's remember, Keynesian economists have a special weakness and pose a special danger in this area. We remember that Lord Keynes, the British imperial representative at Bretton Woods in 1944, tried to advocate a new synthetic world currency, a supranational monstrosity that he called Bancor. Bancor would have been a hoped-up supranational creation looming above the national currencies and separate from them. It would have tended, I think, according to his plan, to concentrate world inflationary pressure against the dollar. It would have discouraged countries from having export surpluses, which is, of course, the only way that third world countries can ever hope to develop, to earn the foreign exchange they need for capital goods. This would have been a key to world stagnation and the perpetuation of world underdevelopment. By contrast, the dollar-based system worked fairly well from 1944 to 1971 and could have worked well further if certain elementary reforms had been established. The British always opposed to fixed exchange rates, always opposed to fixed parities, going back to those competitive devaluations in the blatant beggar my neighbor period in the 1930s. And also the British had used the Canadian dollar, which was never really fixed, always floating, as an example that they kept going of how they could use these fluctuating rates. So interesting that Ria Novosti, in this article by Vlad Grinkovich, warns us, in effect, that many of these stories are planted. Remember, the British attempt is to get problems which may be real, to get in between the parties and to inflame and exacerbate, promote conflict among them. So the transition to a new reserve currency, as the large question of world economic, world monetary reform looms, has got to be done through negotiations. Now, the problems with Obama, of course, are obvious. The Obama regime, very, very much opposed to this kind of negotiation. But don't believe everything you read. Dow 10,000, dollar at almost 150 per euro. So a dollar Dow trade-off, and the crisis continues.
This is Cascadia Public Radio. We'll be right back.
to World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Topley, here in Washington, D.C. Now, let's look at some economic data here. We're in the middle of Wall Street earnings season. How interesting. We'll see how the finance oligarchs and hedge fund hyenas and related jackals on the street have been making out. But first of all, foreclosures continued to rise in the third quarter of 2009, despite the alleged efforts of the Barack Obama administration. We now have a situation where 1 million homes are in the midst of foreclosure. That is up 23%. It's actually just short of 1 million. I think the official figure is an estimated 925,000. We'll call that 1 million homes, 1 million families in the throes of foreclosure. We need legislation to stop that dastardly process dead in its tracks. Ban foreclosures, a freeze, a stop on all foreclosures for 5 years or for the duration of this crisis, and Wall Street eats the losses. God knows they've got enough profits, as we'll tell you in just a minute. We've already had, apparently in the course of 2009, according to these unofficial and estimated data, 250,000 evictions, 250,000 or 230,000 families thrown out on the street by the zombie bankers, even as they are getting money from the TARP, from the Federal Reserve, and from the FDIC. So 1 million homes, approximately, are in the process of being foreclosed on. Now, of course, that's one side of the real economy. The other side of the financial economy, the area of derivatives and looting. J.P. Morgan Chase reports their third quarter earnings, $3.6 billion. The best results for J.P. Morgan Chase in 2 years. Now, of course, we know how they get these results. This is the number one derivatives monster of the world. And what they've been allowed to do now is mark to model. In other words, instead of having to estimate what their worthless, toxic paper would be worth in the market that they claim to admire so much, they don't go to the market. They go to the model, that is to say, a Black-Scholes-based computer program which allows them to estimate anything they want. You can basically call it whatever you like. This institution is bankrupt and insolvent 1,000 times over if we count their derivatives losses, which are conveniently kept in many cases off balance sheet. We have also had Goldman Sachs come in this past week with something around $3 billion. I think Goldman is $3.19 billion in profit. So how about that? 1 million American families are struggling to stay in their homes. 250,000 have already been evicted. And Goldman and J.P. Morgan Chase come in with speculative, parasitical gains in excess of $3 billion each. There's your class enemy. That's who runs the government. And we can also, we know the speed dialing arrangements on Tiny Tim Geithner's cell phone. He's got Blank Fine of Goldman Sachs. He's got Diamond, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, and of course Pandit the Bandit of Citibank. And these are the three that made money this year. Citibank, obviously, an even more blatantly bankrupt institution, has come in with a profit of about $100 million, which was considered to be a miracle. So the three favored zombie banks, and of course this is a cartel, this is a state-sponsored compulsory cartel, this is the dictionary definition of the Mussolini fascist corporate state. It's a state-sponsored compulsory cartel of which J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and, of course, Citibank, willy-nilly, are considered to be the members, and they're going to survive. And they're going to survive at your expense and at public expense. Some others not so certain. Bank of America reports $2 billion in losses. And the reports on Tim Geithner's cell phone is that Bank of America is relegated to some outer circle of the sort of a sub-cartel where it's a lot more dicey and their chances of survival are not so good. But it's very interesting that Bank of America is still determined to pay $30 billion of bonuses to their resident hedge fund hyenas, trading jackals, lampreys, and ticks. $30 billion in bonuses, enabled, of course, by the Treasury through the TARP, the bailout, the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve. Of course, they could have cut their bonuses down to $28 billion and covered their losses, but they chose not to do that. They're going to have those losses, use those for tax purposes, and pay even less. Probably they pay no corporate income tax at this point. So it's an unending series of scams and frauds. And some people are saying, well, of course, they've got to pay those bonuses because those are in the contracts. This is the biggest joke. When the finance oligarchs want to break a trade union contract, boy, do they break it. We've just seen what happened to General Motors, to Chrysler. The UAW contracts in GM and Chrysler were simply shredded. They didn't last for 1 second. Those contracts meant nothing because those were for blue-collar workers, and they don't count. But in this world of globalized, fascistoid crony capitalism, if there's a hedge fund hyena or a yuppie quant who's going to get a bonus, of course, that's sacrosanct. You can't touch that contract, even though only one parasitical individual is involved. We've also got any number of bad results in earnings season. General Electric, their sales are down 20%. That would be, that might be the industrial remnants that still make up GE. But, of course, General Electric is saved by GE Capital, which is, as we've known, and you can read this in Surviving the Cataclysm, a hedge fund in drag. It's been a hedge fund for low these many years. Capital One also in bad shape. Capital One in trouble because of credit card defaults. And we've got the unemployment figure, as people know. It's 10% officially. If you add in the underemployed, you get to 17%. And through various formulas of adding back in the discouraged workers who have dropped off the rolls completely, you get to something in excess of 21% and perhaps approaching 25%. Let's just remind ourselves, at the time Hitler seized power in Germany, unemployment was thought to be officially 30%. And there's some reason to think that those statistics are more accurate than the U.S. one. So it's a depression. It's a world economic depression. And we've got to have a New Deal recovery program to get out and stop these finance oligarchs from running wild. Don't think Obama will do it. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. Let me remind you of the indispensable required reading to understand what's going on around you. That would be Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, April 2000. That would include Obama, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, August 2008, and now joined by the second edition of Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. Second edition issued this spring. Look at these at Topley.net, www.topley.net. That is in the process of being upgraded. The upgrade takes a few more weeks, but there'll be all kinds of things there. So get in the habit of taking a look at Topley.net. And the first time around, go and buy some of those books which are linked at that site. That includes books in German, Japanese, French, Spanish, and Italian versions of various of these books going back to 9/11, Synthetic Terror Made in USA. So both Goldman and J.P. Morgan Chase report profits in excess of $3 billion in one quarter. in one quarter, even as 1 million American families struggle against foreclosure. And these are banks that have been bailed out. They've been saved by the taxpayer through the U.S. government, our government, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, privately owned, of course, and the Treasury. We've also got, in addition to the the banking situation, 98 banks have now blown this year. 98 banks have been seized so far. Even though these big banks are doing well, right, the banks that are in the state-sponsored compulsory cartel, the other banks, the smaller banks, are reporting, for example, we've got 7,000 community banks that are reporting losses of $2.7 billion, which in many cases for those smaller banks is quite a big deal. I mentioned the credit card defaults are hurting, well, everybody who issues credit cards, all of those losses, and that includes credit card defaults, auto loan defaults, foreclosures, of course, and all the rest. That hits various lenders. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Heavy losses for Capital One. The Goldman profit, $3.19 billion, as we said. Citigroup, $101 million with an M. Poor Citibank, not doing that well, but you get the idea. We're expecting, we have 400 troubled banks on the secret FDIC list, and they're likely to be followed by 1,000 more banks going into insolvency, cleaning out the FDIC trust fund. And that is as the residential real estate crisis continues and is joined now increasingly by the commercial real estate crisis, $500 to $600 billion of leases and related purchases coming due, and the likely default rate on that at least one half and maybe as much as two-thirds. So this is now going on. Wall Street troubled this morning by insider trading charges against Galleon Hedge Fund. We've got a hedge fund hyena who has been caught, thrown to the wolves for some reason. Maybe, we'll find out the real reasons, but undoubtedly also richly deserving of this fate is this character, Rajaratnam, accent on rat. Rajaratnam of Galleon Hedge Fund. He is number 559 on the world ranking of billionaires. He's worth $1.3 billion. And if you were watching CNBC this Friday, October 15th, you saw him doing the perp walk down Wall Street. Well, that's fine. We're waiting for Warren Buffett, Greenspan, Geithner, Summers, and the rest of them. We want to see a chorus line of these finance oligarchs in orange jumpsuits before too long. So this is now Rajaratnam charged in insider trading. This is the Galleon Hedge Fund. Three other individuals also charged. Some of these people go back to the world of Bear Stearns. And Bear Stearns, there's another Bear Stearns trial going on, and that is the trial of Ralph Chaffee. Ralph Chaffee, money manager at Bear Stearns, is on trial in Manhattan concerning duplicity, malfeasance, when he was running these Bear Stearns hedge funds, which is actually when it all started, remember? This guy was arrested June 19th, 2008, but the explosion of these funds was about a year earlier. It was in 2007, and that's the beginning of the whole thing, right? Those funds, two hedge funds, brought down Bear Stearns, and then that paved the way for Lehman Brothers to go down, of course, with a big push from Gordon Brown and our British cousins, who were always so solicitous of welfare, always trying to export the depression and beggar their neighbor. So the bailed out banks are getting huge profits. The community banks are generally going down. And worst of all is the situation of the average person, and that we should get more publicity on these outrageous things that are going on. Now, We've also got the derivatives bill, Obama's derivatives bill. This is coming out of the Barney Frank House Committee. The Barney Frank derivatives bill. Now, remember, derivatives are the cause. They are the massive cause of this world economic depression. The worldwide derivatives bubble, best estimate, 1.5 quadrillion, 1,500 trillion of derivatives, probably about two-thirds of that here inside the United States. And this is what made this depression a depression. This is what multiplied and caused chain reaction bankruptcies, chain reaction losses across this whole crazy system. The heart of the matter, as far as the U.S. taxpayer is concerned, of course, the single biggest loss that we've had is AIG. Why AIG? Because they had a hedge fund in London, deregulated on the U.S. side and even more deregulated on the British side. And what did the AIG London hedge fund do? It issued derivatives, $3 trillion, one lousy little hedge fund of one insurance company, $3 trillion of derivatives, exceeding the gross domestic product of France and many other countries. And when that blew, that was going to take down the entire system, because the derivatives, the over-the-counter derivatives in particular, mean that a bankruptcy in one place will then drag dozens, hundreds of firms, scores around the world into similar bankruptcy. So that's why the U.S. government intervened. And remember, the people at Deutsche Bank, at Barclays Bank, at Union Bank of Switzerland, at Societe Generale of France, they're all thanking you, because they've all gotten between $8 to $12 billion of your money through the TARP, thanks to Tiny Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson and the boys at Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs also got $12 billion on that one. This is the biggest single scandal element in the whole thing. Now, after all that, since we know that the derivatives caused the depression, not subprime mortgages and not anything else, but derivatives, 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 something where the average John Q. Public, Joe Sixpack, Joe Schmo, has absolutely no participation. Individuals, it's a rare, it's a one in a million who's dealing in derivatives. Some people buy options, I suppose, if they're that crazy. But derivatives. So what's the answer from Barney Frank? It's basically one big nothing. There's no ban on derivatives, because the obvious thing to do is to say these are going to be banned at some future time. Ban them. That would be serious. If you can't ban them, well, the Tobin tax. Tax them. 1% tax on derivatives. That's what's being demanded by the Democratic Party of La Jolla, California. And there are other things we can do. We'll be back in a minute to talk more about derivatives.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So the Barney Frank Committee has reported out the long-awaited regulation of derivatives, and it is an obscene joke. We reported previously, if anything, the Barney Frank derivatives bill, now out of committee and headed, I guess, to the floor of the House at some point, makes it easier to create new kinds of toxic derivatives that destroy society, destroy jobs, destroy lives, destroy businesses. These things need to be banned. If they can't be banned, tax them out of existence. Get rid of them. Hats off to the La Jolla Democratic Party, who have passed a very courageous resolution. You can see this up at actindependent.org and various other places. It is a 1% Tobin tax on principally derivatives, and there's interest in the derivatives press. There's a whole class of magazines and newsletters that deal only with derivatives. They're interested in the fact that the La Jolla Democratic Party has understood the human dilemma at this point. We're looking now for the California Democratic Party Executive Committee to do something to defend that suffering state. Get some money into your coffers by taxing derivatives. A state can do it. Indeed, indeed. States can tax derivatives if they're sold inside the state. That's like a sales tax. Why is it that derivatives are exempt from sales tax when the shoes and clothing and notebooks for your child's back to school are taxed at 8 to 10%? Why can't the bankers pay 1% on their predatory and toxic derivatives? So this is obviously, it's a way to, you know, the power of the tax is the power to destroy. And the quicker you destroy derivatives, the better off it is. And if you can get some money in the public coffers in the meantime, so much the better. Another way, it's not as good, but it would have been halfway serious, is to impose a reserve requirement on derivatives. In other words, if you're a hedge fund or some other investment bank, or no investment banks left now, but something like that, the law could say whatever you sell, you've got to keep 20% of everything you sell. In other words, if you are putting out credit default swaps, then you have to keep 20%. I don't recommend that one because it's not strong enough, but that would have been at least a step forward. In other words, to force people to face the risks which they're unloading on others, since derivatives, which were marketed as a way to diminish risk, of course, multiply risk geometrically, astronomically, into the ionosphere and indeed into interstellar space. So what does Barney Frank have? Robust capital requirements. Yeah, right. 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives, world GDP, 60 trillion. What's the problem? How can you ever have robust capital requirements when the derivatives are something like 20 times, 25 times the amount of economic activity in the world, even if you're willing to count financial services as economic activity? Some reporting is mandated, very weak, and there's some mandatory exchange trading of derivatives so that it gets out in the open. And then they've set up these clearing houses, which simply, it's like a service to the derivatives mongers, the derivatives merchants. So the Barney Frank derivatives bill is a total monstrosity. Barney Frank has struck out. Barney Frank is obviously a creature of Wall Street. That's who gives him all the money for his campaign fund. He's a creature of the Wall Street hedge fund hyenas and derivatives mongers. And let's put this into perspective. We're told that there's going to be, you know, strict oversight by the Securities Exchange Commission and by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Well, we know what happened to Brooks Liborn of the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, when she tried to even make derivatives reportable 10 years ago. She was hounded out of office by Rubin, Summers, and Greenspan, with the help of Phil Graham and Wendy Graham. It was a bipartisan coalition to impose the to crucify the American public on the cross of derivatives, and indeed the world public. So that's what happened to her. But now we have the Securities and Exchange Commission has hired a new chief executive officer for enforcement. And who is it? It's Adam Storch. Adam Storch, 29-year-old executive from Goldman Sachs. He's a hedge fund hyena. So we've got the fox guarding the hen house here. Adam Storch, 29-year-old Goldman Sachs hedge fund hyena. That's what Goldman Sachs is. It's a hedge fund. No way around it. Not even in drag, openly, blatantly, indecent exposure. So Adam Storch, and he's getting a couple of hundred thousand a year in this job, a 29-year-old whelp from Goldman Sachs, whose only activity in life seems to be speculation, hot money, and other anti-economic activities, is going to be put in charge of enforcement. Now, that allows you to gauge what is the seriousness of the Barney Frank derivatives bill. And this was put in by the head of the SEC, I think that is Shapiro at this point, and I think we've got some others involved in that. So this is a true monstrosity. Now let's leave the the well, a couple of other things. Yeah, let's not leave finance. Let's stay. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a collection of reactionaries, a collection of free market lunatics, adepts of the Chicago School, Milton Friedman, the Austrian School with von Mises and von Hayek. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is concerned that free market, free enterprise ideology is being eroded and undermined. And what they're doing now is launching a campaign. The estimates vary between $25 million and $100 million to remind, educate, and persuade Americans that the free enterprise system is what has made America great and what will once again lead us back to prosperity. So prosperity is just around the corner, says the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but only if we follow that deathly litany: deregulation, privatization, union busting, destruction of the social safety net, right? Attacks on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, attacks on the minimum wage, attacks on food stamps, attacks on unemployment benefits, right? Strip the American people of all of their economic gains and call that reform. What we need, says the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, individual initiative, yeah, individual responsibility in the face of 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives. Ratza ruck, as we say. Hard work, freedom of choice, free exchange of trade, capital, and ideas. Wrong, boys, not free exchange of trade, capital, and ideas, but protectionism, mercantilism, and dirigism. A modest protective tariff of 10 to 15%. Let's put an end to the excesses of free trade. Let's slap on some exchange controls to prevent hot money from coming in and out. That would be a reasonable measure further into the crisis. Obviously, we want to expand trade in capital goods. We don't need beer from Australia. It's not that good. We should be dealing capital goods on the world stage for world economic development rather than the trivialities of various kinds of consumer goods. So the Campaign for Free Enterprise claims that their goal is to create 20 million jobs over the decade. I was looking at these numbers now. This is still in progress, but it looks to me like we would have to create 30 million jobs almost immediately. 30 million jobs to get to full employment. It looks like about 15 million officially unemployed, and if you add in the underemployed and the discouraged ones and some that would enter the labor market if they weren't discouraged in advance, we'd probably need 30 million jobs. We'll check that. But 30 million jobs, with their methods, you won't get jobs. You'll get derivatives, because the money that finance oligarchs get doesn't go into jobs. They don't invest. They gave that up long ago. They manufacture derivatives. See you back in a minute.